Hi, Big Ben Ray here. This is, for the record, program number 1149, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy Part 4. This is being recorded on August 30th of the year 2020. We are going to continue with our analysis, by the way, much of which is review, some of which is new, of events linking the OSS, America's World War II Intelligence Agency, and the Nazi SS, and their evolution through time into not only the CIA, but the Republican Party. And this is part and parcel to something that occurred during and after World War II, which was the sub rosa synthesis of the U.S. into a reintegrated axis involving Japan and Germany. Perhaps the ultimate embodiment of that is the Trilateral Commission. Those three sides, the U.S., Japan, and Germany. There's an old joke, I guess this dates me. It's a good thing the U.S. didn't lose the Second World War. Otherwise, all of our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody would be driving Japanese and German cars. Yeah, and aren't you glad that didn't happen? We are going to, with the Republican Convention just having concluded, and with the Republican campaign right on track in places like Kenosha, Wisconsin, we are going to analyze how the events that we are talking about ultimately go right on through the genesis and composition of the contemporary Republican Party. I have no patience with, and frankly, the ultimate contempt of the capital U and the capital C for those elements who continue to say, "Oh, there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats." Oh, yes, there is. The Democrats are uninspired and somewhat corrupt. So uninspired and uninspiring and somewhat corrupt social Democrats, and the Republicans are Nazis, and they always have been. We will be talking about that, and we will conclude in this program, or perhaps if time mandates, in our next, with a look at William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's campaign director, Ronald Reagan's CIA director, and who set up the intelligence fronts which are active today in the destabilization of China, chiefly, though not exclusively, and most importantly, the National Endowment for Democracy. We are going to continue and conclude an essay that we have used in our last three programs. It is by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott. It is from Covert Action Quarterly number 25 from the winter of 1986, almost 35 years ago. It is titled, "How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other." And I'm going to overlap the reading of the text with what we read last time, the concluding section, or the next section of Peter Dale Scott's essay. "The common interests of the OSS and the SS, the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, was America's World War II intelligence service. We cannot, in this article, review the intricate contacts established throughout the war between the Nazis and the papacy and the U.S., and the U.S. and Germany. However, the common denominator in such informal contacts became the post-war future of Europe and possible joint measures to exclude the Soviet Union from it." One more time, because this is very important. "We cannot in this article review the intricate contacts established throughout the war between the Nazis and the papacy in the U.S. and the U.S. and Germany. However, the common denominator in such informal contacts became the post-war future of Europe and possible joint measures to exclude the Soviet Union from it. This was especially true after Churchill and Roosevelt had proclaimed the policy of unconditional surrender at Casablanca, a policy which not only dismayed Alan Dulles, but threatened the propriety of his continued contacts with members of the German opposition. And I'm going to add parenthetically, the U.S. German corporate slash industrial axis, of which Alan Dulles' brother and fellow Solomon and Cromwell partner, John Foster Dulles, was one of the major architects. Of course, under Eisenhower, Alan Dulles became head of the CIA, and his brother Solomon and Cromwell partner, John Foster Dulles, became Secretary of State. And again, they basically presided over the complete Nazification of the important institutions in this country. Continuing. Yet even after the failure of the July 1944 plot against Hitler, the OSS continued its increasingly questionable liaisons, now chiefly with representatives of SS leaders Heinrich Himmler and Walter Schellenberg. Schellenberg, by the way, head of the Foreign Intelligence for the SD, the SS Intelligence Service. He also was a member of the board of directors of IT&T. Continuing, and it was Prince Max Eugen von Hohenlohe, who was a representative of Walter Schellenberg in his negotiations with Alan Dulles that we recapped in part one of this series. One motive for these OSS-SS contacts was clearly to limit the post-war influence in Western Europe of Soviet power, communist resistance forces, and the civilian communist parties. Another, however, appears to have been to prevent the post-war breakup of German and U.S. intelligence assets, most particularly the Gala networks in Eastern and Central Europe, which by 1945 were under the control of Otto Skorzeny and the SS. And the OSS itself, let me reread this sentence. Another, however, appears to have been to prevent the post-war breakup of German and U.S. intelligence assets, most particularly the Gala networks in Eastern and Central Europe, which by 1945 were under the control of Skorzeny and the SS, and the OSS itself, which by 1945 was facing increasingly public attack inspired by U.S. military intelligence and the FBI. It is interesting that Galen knew of Carl Wolff's contacts with Dulles as early as January of 1945, the month in which they were initiated, parenthetically, the official history of the Galen incorporation into U.S. intel has those contacts being made after the German surrender in May of 1945. In fact, they were going on well before. One more time. It is interesting that Galen knew of Carl Wolff's contacts with Dulles as early as January of 1945, the month in which they were initiated. From this same period, he began to consolidate his networks for survival after Hitler's downfall, which is to say he already expected to reach a modus vivendi with the Americans. In April of 1945, 1 month before the war ended, Dulles asked Frank Wisner to begin talks with Galen, who was not taken into U.S. custody until May 20th. On the Galen side, a plan, quote, to gain contact with the Americans, unquote, was approved on April 4th and continued without interruption even after Hitler dismissed Galen on April 9th. Curiously, the Operation Sunrise contacts between Wolff and Dulles became most intense in the second half of April of 1945, even though at that time both Wolff and Dulles knew they had no authority to negotiate a surrender. By the way, SS General Carl Wolff was Heinrich Himmler's personal adjutant, and Joseph McCarthy, in his hearings, drew on an intelligence network called the POND, which on the American side was managed by a former U.S. military intelligence officer named John Frenchy Grombach, G-R-O-M-B-A-C-H. He was drawing on intel provided to him by a network of SS officers headed up by Carl Wolff. Remember that Joe McCarthy's top counsel was Roy Cohn. He was Donald Trump's political mentor and legal counsel for many years. Continuing. Curiously, the Operation Sunrise contacts between Wolff and Dulles became most intense in the second half of April of 1945. Even though at that time both Wolfe and Dulles knew they had no authority to negotiate a surrender. On April 17th, Wolfe visited Berlin, where Galen and his headquarters were still located, to be told by Hitler personally that he should, quote, temporize in his talks with Dulles because it was still too early to consider a surrender or even serious negotiation, unquote. On the same day, Dulles returned to his Bern, Switzerland headquarters from the OSS European Theater headquarters in Paris to receive, on April 21st, an April 17th order from the Combined Chiefs of Staff, quote, to liquidate Operation Sunrise by cutting off all contact with Karl Wolf. Undaunted by such restrictions, both men, meaning Alan Dulles and Karl Wolf, continued to negotiate, accompanied for the first time by a German army representative, Colonel von Schweinitz. Wolf came to Switzerland counting on, quote, his personal reputation with the Anglo-Americans, unquote, to extract guarantees from Dulles that the, quote, idealistic, unquote, and, quote, decent, unquote, men of the army, that's the German army, the Nazi party, and the SS would be able to play, quote, an active part in the reconstruction, unquote. Dulles, on his part, misrepresented von Schweinitz's explicitly limited instructions as a, quote, full power, unquote, to negotiate. Later, after General Wolf had returned to Italy and found himself facing capture by Allied partisans, Dulles allowed an OSS team to participate, together with two SS men, in the successful rescue and exfiltration of Wolf to Switzerland. The historian Bradley Smith calls this, quote, frenzied pursuit of sunrise, unquote, by Dulles, a mere reflex action and failure to realize that Allied victory was imminent in any case. In fact, Dulles and Donovan had to mislead their superiors if their plans for the post-war use of the SS were to succeed. As R. Harris Smith, himself a former CIA officer, reports deadpan, only Wolfe's sudden and unexpected offer to sign an unconditional surrender on April 22nd convinced the State Department to reverse its earlier order and to allow Sunrise to proceed. But no such offer had been made by Wolf. It was merely an illusion from Dulles' unjustified commentaries, which, quote, ran roughshod over the minimal rules of caution and good sense, unquote. The OSS policy of rescuing key fascist leaders appears moreover to have been systematic. The next day, on April 28th, Dulles' aide, Daddario, risked his life in Milan to save the fascist Marshal Rodolfo Graziani, G-R-A-Z-I-A-N-I, from vengeful socialist partisans. On April 29th, in Rome, OSS officer James Jesus Angleton would similarly rescue Prince Valerio Borghese by disguising him as a U.S. Army officer. After the war, Graziani and Borghese became leaders of the neo-fascist MSI party, while their wartime cadres were apparently helped to new anti-communist careers with the support of the Vatican and ultimately the U.S. In the months after the war, Angleton helped other fascists and Nazis to, quote, escape, unquote, from prison camps, supplying them when necessary with new identities. There seems to be no question that by April of 1945, the OSS was recruiting Nazis and fascists to help mobilize against post-war communism. As a recent historian has observed, quote, the history of OSS, which is indistinguishable from the secret political history of the war, is marked by a preoccupation with communism almost as intense as its commitment to victory against Germany. at least some of the SS men who, in the last weeks after the war, negotiated with the OSS, were treated thereafter as allies. Wilhelm Hüttel, for example, H-O-E-T-T-L, who had transmitted an offer from SS Deputy Head Kaltenbrunner, worked after the war, like his former subordinate Schwind, as an informant for the CIC in Austria. Walter Rauf, who had negotiated in Milan with Dulles' aide Daddario, was also spared, despite having directed the mobile gas chambers in Nazi-occupied Russia. By his own account, which had been reported as fact in the U.S. press, Rauf, quote, escaped, unquote, after his arrest by U.S. troops to move with Vatican help first to Vatican City and then to Syria. British and French sources agree, however, that Rauf, by as early as June of 1945, had established himself in Genoa. There, with the aid of Cardinal Siri, S-I-R-I, Bishop of Genoa, Rauf organized a transit camp where as many as 5,000 fleeing Nazis were sheltered before their departure to Argentina, Syria, or Egypt. The French Nazi Humper Beata Klarsfeld agreed that, like his Kameradenwerk ally Schwind, Rauf, too, was working with U.S. intelligence before escaping to Chile. This seems probable inasmuch as Schwind was working for the Austrian CIC while setting up the Murano station of what became known as the Rat Line. At some point, moreover, certainly by the early 1950s, the CIA and the Galen organization were working together to move Galen agents headed by Otto Skorzeny to Egypt. Long before these officially authorized movements, Donovan and Dulles must have seen that with a global network of its men already in place, the Galen organization would be an even more impressive asset in their case for a post-war CIA. Through their connections with the Galen organization, Skorzeny, Rauf, Barbie, and Schwinn all became, in effect, instruments of CIA intelligence and covert action policies. In so doing, they contributed significantly to the establishment of fascist-style oppression in the new countries to which they had moved, in Chile, Bolivia, Paraguay, Argentina, and Peru. One legacy of this oppression is the system of death squads now operative in Central America. Another has been the involvement of men like Barbie and their political clients in the highly organized Latin American drug traffic. And that again from the essay How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other by Peter Dale Scott in Covert Action number 25 from the winter of 1986. Now, much of that will not appear to be revelatory to veteran listeners. However, I'm about to begin my 42nd year on the air, and over the decades, an awful lot has been eclipsed. Now, in the early part of that essay, Peter Dale Scott talked about how Josef Mengele, the infamous angel of death of Auschwitz, was part of these networks with people like Klaus Barbie, Walter Rauf, Friedrich Schwind, and others. And he, that is to say, Peter Dale Scott, speculates that Mengele, too, was in all probability incorporated into the U.S. national security establishment, albeit while resident primarily in Latin America. And he compares Mengele's career with that of Walter Schreiber, Mengele's colleague in the gruesome experiments at Auschwitz. Walter Schreiber became involved with the U.S. Air Force and directing its efforts in bacteriological warfare. Mengele, too, has been documented as working with the U.S. National Security Establishment. This, however, while he was in Paraguay. We are going to Once again, go back to the remarkable book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in 1981 by Lyle Stewart in hardcover and authored by the heroic Paul Manning. This book is available for download for free on the Spitfire List website. It is also available, along with the other books in this, in the anti-fascist books for download section on the 32 gigabyte flash drive that is available, from a link on this website. That flash drive is going to be updated within a month or two to incorporate the, latest material. From page 213 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, we read, "An attitude of benevolence toward Bormann, the German who created so much commercial activity for them, is maintained by Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Uruguay, and Paraguay. In the last named country, the son of a Bavarian cavalry officer, President Stroessner," that's Alfredo Stroessner, S-T-R-O-E-S-S-M-E-R, "cooperates with the U.S. military authorities and the CIA, as he does with Bormann and his representatives. During the Vietnam War, President Stroessner permitted the U.S. Army Chemical Corps and the CIA to send in teams of 2,500 men to carry out field tests in the Mato Grosso jungle of chemicals for use in Vietnam. In one instance, several American soldiers became casualties when they accidentally were sprayed with the gas. They were taken to a Paraguayan military field hospital. The doctor who treated them was Josef Mengele, now a Paraguayan citizen and an officer in the Paraguayan Army Medical Corps. Under Mengele's treatment, all of the soldiers recovered. None, of course, knew the true identity of their medical benefactor. The Israelis have tried repeatedly to extradite Mengele, who was the notorious doctor of the Auschwitz concentration camp. But when President Stroessner is approached through diplomatic channels for such a purpose, he responds, quote, "Shall I also extradite the 1,500 Jews who have made a good life for themselves and who have contributed so much to our economic growth?" Despite the assistance Bormann, beginning again, despite the assistance Bormann has received from various leaders in Latin America since his arrival, including help from members of U.S. embassies and consulates and several CIA station chiefs, Heinrich Mueller continues to exercise extreme caution in protecting Bormann." Heinrich Mueller, of course, not only head of the Gestapo, but he also went to work for U.S. Intel after the war. He is the security director for the deadly Bormann network and holds the, or held, I'm sure he has passed away now, but he held the title of Minister of the Interior in Exile. In For the Record 664, we talked about Mengele and his links to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and which was responsible for dispatching him to his position at Auschwitz, which was viewed by his superior there, Karl Freiherr von Schur, as being an ideal environment for further professional advancement, because he could do experiments there that were not possible elsewhere. In that aforementioned For the Record 664, we also related that there was unimpeached testimony at Nuremberg from that basically before Mengele, before his he began his experiments on the twins, basically filled out paperwork in duplicate, one copy of which was sent to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. That was capitalized by the Rockefeller Foundation, and it is a pretty good bet that after the war, the Rockefeller interests came into possession of that paperwork. Now, in this exact time period, we are going to take a look at another really important fellow. And bear in mind what we have just looked at in connection with Alan Dulles and the SS and the OSS. Bear in mind, too, something we looked at in For the Record 1058, and that was Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty's testimony or his witnessing in October of 1944 of the inclusion of Third Reich intelligence officers in a series of flights that he commanded that were taking U.S. POWs from the Balkans to Egypt. And that was obviously concrete evidence of the shifting of allegiance from ostensibly the Allies to the Axis. And this was being done behind FDR's back. I suspect very strongly that FDR's death was not natural. Now, we're going to take a look at another fellow who was in the very middle of this mix at this time. Reading now from OSS, The Secret History of America's First Central Intelligence Agency by R. Harris Smith. Copyright 1972 and 2005 by R. Harris Smith and published in softcover by the Lions Press. Guess who was in charge of OSS operations in Germany in this time period? The time period is late 1944 and 1945. As an emergency measure, the new Special Intelligence Branch Chief, a wealthy 32-year-old New York tax lawyer, William Casey, was given overall operational control of German projects. Again, as an emergency measure, the new Special Intelligence Branch Chief, that is of the OSS, a wealthy 32-year-old New York tax lawyer, William Casey, was given overall operational control of German projects. And William Casey, as we will see, evolved into being one of the principals in forming the Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, that is literally the Nazi branch of the Republican Party. It is a dominant element of that. Briefly, in the 1948 election, Thomas Dewey was the Republican nominee once again, as he was in 1944. His key campaign official was Alan Dulles, whose official title was speechwriter. He basically managed Thomas Dewey's campaign. Thomas Dewey's vice presidential candidate was Earl Warren, the former governor of California and later Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court and the head of the Warren Commission, on which Alan Dulles also served. Many people have viewed that as really the Dulles Commission, since he was the dominant power on the Warren Commission that officially covered up, well, not officially, but really covered up, not investigated, the assassination of President Kennedy. And we are going to briefly review some aspects of the Reinhard-Gehlen spy outfit, which again was being fused with the OSS. This from an essay that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. From Covert Action Quarterly number 35 from the fall of 1990, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby. And as we will see, the Gehlen Organization and its cooperation and incorporation into U.S. intel was approved from the highest levels of the German government and by a German chain of command that was still in effect. Gehlen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Gehlen and Admiral Dönitz were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Gehlen sought and received approval from Dönitz, too. In other words, the German chain of command was still in effect and it approved of what Gehlen was doing with the Americans. And the whole concept of the deal he was about to offer his conquerors had been approved by a Nazi chain of command that was still functioning despite what the world thought and still does think was the Nazis' unconditional surrender. And as we had noted in past discussion of that essay, General Franz Halberg, who had been Galen's chief of staff during the war, also approved of the deal. Now, part of the Galen organization, or Freunde Herrer Ost, or FHO, were Eastern European fascist networks whose uniting factor was their relationship with the OSS, and which, as we will see, became key elements of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council. Speaking of Galen, his FHO was connected in this role with a number of secret fascist organizations in the countries to Germany's east. These included Stefan Bandera's B faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUNB, parenthetically currently dominating the national security establishment and educational establishment of, quote, independent, unquote, and quote, democratic, unquote, Ukraine, continuing Romania's Iron Guard, the Ustashi of Yugoslavia, the Vanagis of Latvia, and after the summer of 1942, Vlasov's army, the band of defectors from Soviet communism, marching behind former Red Hero General Andrei Vlasov. Later on in the war, Galen placed one of his top men in control of foreign armies west, which broadened his power. And then, after Admiral Wilhelm Canaris was purged and his Abwehr Intelligence Service cannibalized by the SS, Galen became, in effect, Nazi Germany's overall top intelligence chief. Now, bear in mind what we looked at in the our Harris Smith book. Again, as in the late 1944, as an emergency measure, the new OSS Special Intelligence Branch chief, a wealthy 32-year-old New York tax lawyer, William Casey, was given overall operational control of German projects. And reviewing something we have spoken about many times, and that is the coalescence of the Nazi branch of the Republican Party. Now, bear in mind, at the same time, what was an illegal domestic U.S. intelligence operation was the American component of a foreign intelligence operation, which was the use of these Nazi and fascist networks as active combatants in the rear of the Red Army that continued until the early 1950s, with these combatants basically having switched uniforms from the Wehrmacht and SS to the CIA and the OPC of Frank Wisner. From The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press. Now, bearing in mind that Alan Dulles's that Thomas Dewey's top campaign official was Alan Dulles. Frustration over Truman's 1948 election victory over Dewey, which they blamed on the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote, impelled Dulles and his protege Richard Nixon to work toward the realization of the fascist freedom fighter presence in the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles's confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language-speaking Croatians and their fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters, unquote, during the 1950s, and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. As vice president, he even received Eastern European fascists in the White House. And by the way, something we looked at in AFA program number 2 was the fact that the fight on the floor of Congress to break up the IG Farben chemical cartel was led by Jerry Voorhees, who was defeated by Richard Nixon in his first congressional campaign. And in our discussions with Russ Baker, the author of the book Family of Secrets about the Bush family, Russ Baker opined that it was Prescott Bush who actually recruited Richard Nixon to run against Jerry Voorhees, who again was leading the fight on the floor of Congress to break up I.G. Farben, the coalescence of which had been realized by John Foster Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, Alan Dulles' brother, and Secretary of State while Alan Dulles was head of the CIA. More from the book The Secret War Against the Jews. As a young movie actor in the 1950s, Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an OPC front named the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts, which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, parenthetically, he was also Ronald Reagan's campaign manager in 1980, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the U.S. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. Confidential interviews, former members of the OPC, and former members of British Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Those are the sources. And still more about the Nazi branch of the Republican Party. It was George H.W. Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named, who presided over the formal coalescence of these groups into a permanent branch of the Republican Party. Again, from the Secret War Against the Jews. It was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigre, unquote, a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the U.S. And again, these figures, Richard Nixon, vice president twice under Eisenhower, then president twice, although he was replaced by former Warren Commission member Gerald Ford, Alan Dulles was head of the CIA under Eisenhower, and his brother John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State. Ronald Reagan was the front person for this group. William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager in 1980 and became his CIA director, was one of the central figures in the importation of these Nazis into the U.S., and George H.W. Bush, who was Ronald Reagan's vice president for two terms and then became president of the U.S. himself in 1988. His son presided over what I think it was president for two terms in 2000 to 2004 and 2004 to 2008. The selections for Ronald Reagan's campaign appointments was made by a woman named Helena von Dahn. She was a protege of Otto von Bolsting, who was Adolf Eichmann's superior in administering the so-called final solution to the Jewish problem. She was also a very close friend of and associate of Donald Trump. Now, briefly reviewing some things about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. This is from, and by the way, as we have noted in the introduction to the anti-fascist books for download, it was really globalization that manifested as fascism, or the first major role first major wave of globalization, as I wrote in the introduction to that. Some of the books presented here illustrate the extent to which fascism, Nazism in particular, was an outgrowth of globalization and the construction of international monopolies or cartels. Key to understanding this phenomenon is analysis of the Webb-Pomeroy Act, legislated near the end of the First World War. A loophole in the antitrust legislation of 1914, it effectively legalized the formation of cartels, international monopolies, for firms that were barred from domestic monopolistic practices. Decrying what they viewed as excessive and restrictive regulation here in and beginning again, decrying what they viewed as excessive and restrictive, quote, regulation, quote, here in the U.S., U.S.-based transnational corporations invested their profits from the industrial boom of the 1920s abroad, primarily in Japan and Germany. This process might well be viewed as the real beginning of what we now know as globalization. It was this capital that drove the engines of conquest that subdued both Europe and Asia during the conflict. And noting from another piece of work by John Loftus, how the Bush family made its fortune from the Nazis. This was on John Loftus's website, but that is no longer up. This is from Jim Craven's blog of September 27th of 2000, of the Bush family and their involvement with the Thesens and globalization. Several decades after the war, investigative reporter Paul Manning, Edward R. Murrow's colleague, stumbled across the Thesen interrogations in the U.S. National Archives. Manning intended to write a book about Nazi money laundering, and Manning's manuscript was a dagger at Alan Dulles' throat. His book specifically mentioned the Bank for Handel und Schifffahrt by name, albeit in passing, and the significance of that. And we've talked about this in the past, including in For the Record program number 1060. And John Loftus writes in his conclusion, but what did the Bush family know about their Nazi connection, and when did they know it? As senior members of Brown Brothers Harriman, they, meaning George Herbert Walker, George Herbert Walker Bush's grandfather and the great-grandfather of George W. Bush, and Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W. Bush and the grandfather of George W. Bush. As senior members of Brown Brothers Harriman, they had to have known that their American clients, such as the Rockefellers, were investing heavily in German corporations, including Thiessen's giant Vereinigte Stahlwerke. As noted historian Christopher Simpson repeatedly documents, it is a matter of public record that Brown Brothers' investments in Nazi Germany took place under the Bush family stewardship. It should be recalled that in January of 1937, he hired, that is to say Prescott Bush, hired Alan Dulles to cloak, unquote, his accounts. But cloak from whom? Did he expect that happy little Holland was going to declare war on America? The cloaking operation only makes sense in anticipation of a possible war with Nazi Germany. If Union Bank was not the conduit for laundering the Rockefellers' Nazi investments back to America, then how could the Rockefeller-controlled Chase Manhattan Bank end up owning 31% of the Thyssen Group after the war? It should be noted that the Thyssen Group, TBG, is now the largest industrial conglomerate in Germany, and with a net worth of more than $50 billion, one of the wealthiest corporations in the world. TBG is so rich that it even bought out the Krupp family, famous arms makers for Hitler, leaving the Thyssens as the undisputed champion survivors of the Third Reich. Where did the Thyssens get the startup money to rebuild their empire with such speed after World War II? A fortune this size could only have come from the Thyssen profits made from rearming the Third Reich and then hidden first from the Nazi tax arbiters and then from the Allies. The Bushes knew perfectly well that Brown Brothers was the American money channel into Nazi Germany, and that Union Bank was the secret pipeline to bring the Nazi money back to America from Holland. The Bushes had to have known how the secret money circuit worked, because they were on the board of directors in both directions. Brown Brothers out, Union Bank in. Indeed. Now, we are once again going to jump back to groups like the Iron Guard, the all-important OUNB, and the other members of the ABN. These organizations, even while they were part of the Galen Organization, CIA, and the Republican Party, were getting financing from the Galen Organization when it was the BND, the official West German Intelligence Service, now the German Intelligence Service. From Galen, Spy of the Century by E.H. Cookridge, published in hardcover by Random House, copyright 1971. Galen even set up a number of cells in the U.S., As early as 1963, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee discussed the activities of the Julius Klein Public Relations Company, which had established branches in New York, Washington, and Los Angeles, and also in Canada, employing a fairly numerous staff without apparently engaging on any publicity business. From this firm, the trail led to the Association of American Citizens of German Origin, which was receiving large subsidies from an unspecified federal German government department, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, it was later established. This foreign subsidy amounted to the handsome sum of $280,000 in 1964 and was increased in later years. By the way, that was a lot of money in 1964. Continuing. Not so satisfactory at first were the explanations of Galen's connections with the large organizations of Ukrainians, Poles, Lithuanians, Latvians, and other East European immigrants in the U.S., which received finance and advice from three registered BND agents: Roman Henlinger, alias Dr. Grau, Victor Solomon, and Alexander Weber, W-I-E-B-E-R. The point being that even as these Eastern European fascist groups were working as part of the Republican Party and with the CIA, they were still being financed by the Galen Organization when it was the West German Intelligence Service. we're going to supplement that. We're going to read some excerpts from an essay that was never officially published. It was authored by someone whose work is well known to veteran listeners to this program. However, I'm not going to mention who it was since this was never actually published. It is titled Mengele and Bullis, the SS-OSS Connection, Transnationalism and the Cold War. And it dovetails very effectively with the essay that dominated this series from Covert Action number 25 and a discussion of the Galen BNB financing of these same groups that were working with CIA and as part of the Republican Party with William Casey. In other words, the FBI was persuaded to ignore the political activities of these groups, not the least of which was to help consolidate the original American support for the World Anti-Communist League, or WACL. Other political groups and lobbyists were subsidized by Galen and the BNB without even an excuse of an intelligence pretext. One was the Federation of American Citizens of German descent in the USA, whose chairman, Austin App, an associate of former WACL chairman Roger Pearson, is attempting to debunk the historicity of the SS Holocaust. Another was the right-wing public relations firm of Washington lobbyist Julius Klein, who, according to one of Barbie's CIC handlers, had a, quote, special relationship, unquote, with Barbie in Germany at that time. Klein, representing the Committee for Return of Confiscated German and Japanese Property, unquote, lobbied unsuccessfully for a 1954 bill introduced by Senator Dirksen, which would have contravened the 1945 German Reparations Agreement and restored the U.S. properties of I.G. Farben to their German owners. A surprising supporter of this bill, which was vigorously opposed by the Justice Department, was Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. Now, what we are going to look at next concerns once again William Casey, and we are going to take a look at information that not only further fleshes out his role in this concatenation, but also suggests that he may very well have been involved, as it should come as no surprise, with the deadly Borman Capital Network. Again, the institution, I believe, will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. Reading from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, again by Paul Manning. The German South American group also had direct access to the Nixon White House through their representatives in Washington and were proud of the fact that Bibi Rebozo was President Nixon's closest friend. For, knowingly or unknowingly, Rebozo processed millions of their dollars through his Florida bank as part of normal commercial operations. And as we will see, that may very well have been linked to William Casey, something we looked at in, for the record, 1142, that is Cap Cities Incorporated, and the milieu we have been looking at. Returning once again to that unpublished essay that dovetails very nicely with the Peter Dale Scott essay in Covert Action number 25, Mengele and Bullis, the SS-OSS Connection, Transnationalism and the Cold War, we read, and bearing in mind the fact that Bibi Rebozo, Nixon's good friend, was apparently trafficking funds from the Borman Network through his bank. And the author here writes, one of the most researched and ill-understood areas about such payments concerns a Bahamas casino, Paradise Island, which figured in investigative stories about Richard Nixon and Watergate. The casino was owned by an American company, Mary Carter Paint Company, later known as Resorts International, and there is no question but that in 1968, the chairman of the company, James Crosby, quote, made a $100,000 contribution to the Nixon campaign. It took the unusual form of 34 checks, 33 of them for $3,000 apiece, the last for $1,000. In 1972, Howard Hunt, in his double capacity as an employee of the Nixon White House and of a CIA-linked public relations firm, the Robert Mullum Agency, did certain work for Intertel, an investigative and intelligence subsidiary of Resorts International. Intertel was trying to hush up allegations based on a controversial internal memorandum from a woman named Gita Beard about a $400,000 payoff to the Republican Party in exchange for settlement of a Justice Department suit against AT&T. In 1972, Crosby made no acknowledged contribution to Nixon, even though he was reportedly asked by Nixon's personal lawyer, Herbert Kalmbach. But in 1973, the New York Times ran a story about peculiar movements between the Paradise Island Casino and the Key Biscayne Bank, which belonged to then-President Richard Nixon's friend, B.B. Rebozo. There was speculation that the bank and the casino were laundering funds for the president. The story focused on the movements of a close friend of Rebozo called Seymour Alter, quote, whom a lot of people called Resort's bagman, unquote. Testimony by an IRS informant to a House subcommittee 2 years later suggested that the money was in fact skimmed from another of James Crosby's companies, the Paradise Island Bridge Company, and that Alter had on at least one occasion carried $200,000 of such money and been met on the Key Biscayne dock by B.B. Rebozo himself. They headed for either B.B.'s or Nixon's house. Throughout the Watergate scandal, there were rumors among investigative reporters that Nixon and Rebozo were silent partners with Crosby in the lucrative bridge company. I myself was sent a list of the shareholders at this time. The list, later confirmed by Crosby in public testimony, did not show Nixon or Rebozo. It did, however, name a number of German and Swiss investors. One of these, for example, was Dr. Heinz Rosterg, R-O-S-T-E-R-G, of Lausanne, Switzerland, a former principal stockholder and director of the Wintershall Potash concern. Wintershall was one of the major subsidiaries of BASF, the largest single successor firm to IG Farben. And skipping down. The release of Baron Krupp and other industrialists fulfilled an earlier demand to McCoy from Hermann Abs, who himself narrowly escaped prosecution at Nuremberg. Abs was the first post-war chairman of BASF, the IG Farben successor company represented among the stockholders of the Paradise Island Bridge Company. Might not the OSS-SS connection also throw light on the unexplained interlock between James Crosby's company, Resorts International, the unexplained interlock between James Crosby's company, Might not the OSS-SS connection also throw light on the unexplained interlock between James Crosby's Resorts International, tightly controlled by the related and doubly intermarried Crosby and Murphy families, and Capital Cities Broadcasting, the major investment of the CIA's present director, William Casey? Casey would be the logical person to have established the original connection between the Crosby-Murphy families and their mysterious German-Swiss partners. For it was Casey in 1944 and 1945 who was given overall operation control of OSS German projects and, quote, coordinated the over 150 men whom OSS sent in to Germany. With Dulles, Wisner, and Forgan, Casey was also one of the OSS veterans who lobbied successfully for a CIA which could legitimately utilize the resources of the Galen organization. And it was Cap Cities who purchased ABC. There's more to this, but there is unfortunately no more time. This concludes, for the record, program number 1149, the space plane COVID-19, the paperclip legacy, part 4. This is being recorded on August 30th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.